Therefore, considering what's best for you, Virgil said to Dante, I judge that you should follow, I should guide, and hence through an eternal space lead on. There you shall hear shrill cries of desperation, and see those spirits mourning ancient pain, who all cry out for death to come once more, and then you'll see those souls who live in fire content to hope whenever that time comes. They too will be among the blessed choirs, to which, if you shall ever wish to rise, a soul will come far worthier than me. I must at parting leave you in her care. Reigning on high, there is an emperor, who since I was a rebel to his law, will not allow his city as my goal. Through me you go to the grief-racked city. Through me to everlasting pain you go. Through me, you go and pass among lost souls. Justice inspired my exalted creator. I am a creature of the holiest power, of wisdom in the highest and of primal love. Nothing till I was made, only eternal beings, and I endure eternally. Surrender as you enter every hope you have. These were the words that, written in dark tomes, I saw there on the summit of a door. I turned, their meaning, sir, for me is hard. And he is answering, as though he understood. Your needs must here surrender all your doubts. All taint of cowardice must here be dead. We now have come where, as I have said, you'll see in suffering the souls of those who've lost the good that intellect desires to win. And then he placed his hand around my own. He smiled to give me some encouragement and set me on to enter secret things. Sighing, sobbing, moans of plaintive wailing all echoed here through air where no star shone. And I, as this began to weep. Discordant tongues, harsh accents of horror, tormented words, the twang of rage, strident voices, the sound as well of smacking hands. Together these all stirred a storm that swelled forever in the darkened air where no time was, as sand swept in the breathing spires of wind. I turned my head, tight-bound in confusion, to say to my master, what is it that I hear? Who can these be so overwhelmed by pain? This baleful condition is one, he said, that grips those souls who live contemptibly, were void alike of honour and ill fame. These all commingle with a noisome choir of all angels who, not rebels, yet not true to God, existed for themselves alone. To keep their beauty whole, the heavens spurned them, nor were the depths of hell receive them in, lest truly wicked souls boast over them. And I, what can it be so harsh, so heavy, that draws such loud lamentings from these crowds? And he replied, my answer can be brief. These have no hope that death will ever come, and so degraded is the life they lead. All look with envy on all other fates. The world allows no glory to their name. Mercy and justice alike despise them. Look us not speak of them. Look them pass on. I did look intently. I saw a banner running so rapidly, whirling forwards, that nothing, it seemed, would ever grant a pause. Drawn by that banner was so long a trail of men and women, I should not have thought that death could ever have unmade so many. A few I recognized, and then I saw and knew beyond all doubt the shadow of the one who made, from cowardice, the great denial. So I, at that instant, was wholly sure this congregation was that worthless mob, loathsome alike to God and their own enemies. These wretched souls were never truly live. They now went naked and were sharply spurned by wasps and hornets thriving all around. The insects streaked their face of each with blood mixing with tears. The lines ran down and then were garnered at their feet by filthy worms. And when I got myself to look beyond others, I saw were ranged along the bank of some great stream. Allow me, sir, I said, to know who these might be. What drives them on and makes them all, as far as in the weak light as I discern, so eager for the crossing? That will, of course, be clear to you, he said. Whence once our footsteps are set firm upon the melancholic shores of Acheron. At this, ashamed, my eyes cast humbly down, fearing my words had weighed on him too hard. I held my tongue until we reached the stream. Look now. Towards us, in a boat, there came an old man, yelling, hair all white and aged. Degenerates, your fate is sealed. Cry, woe. Don't hope you'll ever see the skies again. I'm here to lead you to the farther shore, into eternal shadow, heat and chill. That was a segment from the third canto of the Inferno, but I think, as you can surmise from that, that's quite a compelling entry, not just into the Inferno itself, but also into the topic of hell, Dante's Inferno more specifically. At the most fundamental level, Inferno represents an absence of God, a consequence of its denizens' conscious rejection of and separation from God. The loss of a direct communication with God, or this beatific vision, hence the poetic masterstroke of Dante to have Beatrice as his guide in paradise. The corollary to God's absence is God's definitive judgment over those eternal souls. If said judgment is to be found in the deprivation of God's benevolence alone, or are there aspects of judgment and specific punishments predicated on certain gradations of sin? These are the questions we must ask when judging the utility of the concept of Inferno and of Dante's literary creation. By utility, I don't mean in an exclusively theological sense, but rather, how can these concepts help uncover for us something of this historic medieval mindset, a window, as it were, and a window onto Christianity more generally? Hell, as a much broader concept, is linked through scripture to the Sheol of the Hebrew Bible. Abaddon, or Apollyon, flitting from the Hebrew to the Greek, represents the bottomless pit of the abyss, and also oblivion. Oblivion meaning here literally to forget. But conversely, it represents an angelic embodiment of destruction, a concept made in the Latin Vulgate, Apocalypse, where the entity is referenced as the exterminans, literally the destroyer. We have references to the Greek Hades and Tartarus. Indeed, with Tartarus, there is a contentious translation of that concept directly into the Koine iteration of the second epistle of St. Peter. In Hades and Sheol, there is an aspect of punishment, though it is not explicit. It is an afterlife in an underworld, as opposed to a source of soul destruction, like Abaddon. Indeed, this is where the utility of the word hell becomes very questionable, as like the Sheol, hell, or Helheim, is a netherworld, a covered realm in Germanic mythology. The judgment aspect to Helheim is that its denizens did not die in glorious combat, unlike the denizens of Valhalla. Indeed, this is a concept which is incompatible with Christianity. And yet, Germanic language groups have inherited the word, which has become synonymous with Christianity, ironically for those who critique the word from without Christianity. Indeed, the Latin word infernus, from which inferno is derived, is a reference to the lower regions of Hades. The association of inferno with fire comes from a Latin translation of Gehenna. Gehenna, which is a physical valley surrounding Jerusalem, cursed by the prophet Jeremiah, an essential inspiration for Dante, after the kings of Judah were involved in the ritualistic burning of children. In the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, Gehenna refers to the afterlife and where its associations with fire are made explicit. There are also other interesting implications when coming to Gehenna after Christ is crucified on Golgotha. We note that we have the harrowing of hell. So indeed, Gehenna may not just represent hell, but represent a gateway to hell surrounding Jerusalem. And I'm also put in mind of the dream journey of Muhammad over Jerusalem. Maybe again, it's both the access point to hell as it is to purgatory and ultimately the heavens, but I don't have time to get involved in Islamic readings of Dante for this stream. From these myriad mythical, historical and scriptural sources, we arrive at the Inferno. Greek mythology adds, at the very least, rich, allegorical rich allegorical content and symbolism, without which the Inferno as a creative construct could not exist. St. Thomas Aquinas had explored the topic of hell in his Summa Theologica. To this, we add the integral role of prophecy in Catholicism, most notably the Apocalypse of St. John, but also the visions of St. Columba. St. Catherine of Siena experienced her visions a few decades after Dante's death. Then finally, we arrive at the more secularized conception of the poet as prophet, a la Thomas Carlyle, returning to Dante's Debt to Virgil. And here I'm reading a very brief segment by Charles Buxton on his Prophets of Heaven and Hell. The poet who makes the universe the subject of his poem undertakes a work so supremely difficult and complicated that without an extraordinary and apparently miraculous combination of powers and sympathies, he must ignominiously fall. That is why in 2,000 years or more, only four men have emerged who are capable of bearing the burden and accomplishing the colossal task. Such a poet must cover the dry bones of intellectual formulation with flesh and blood. He must convey to the mass of ordinary men and women some kind of impression of the whole of life in all its aspects. He must make them feel that they are concerned in what he is saying and that he is giving them guidance in the conduct of life. He must engage in their interest and attention by means of what is readable and exciting. This is the method of imagination. He must not only grasp the whole, but embody it in an image, a picture of a new creation with a thousand elements fused into one with a life of its own. What Buxton really is referring to here, which Dante is in some senses an exemplar, is of course the talent of originality. Now it comes to the actual construction of the Commedia, and I will be reading again from Brilli Elisa's The Biography and Autobiographies of Dante's New Lives, which is really the textbook for this series. If you had to have one single book to as a companion for this series, but it's only a short segment this time. The Commedia, i.e. the Divine Comedy, which of course comprises the Inferno, cannot be defined. The best we can do is describe it a poem, tercets that recounts in the first person the journey of a still living man into the three realms of the afterlife in 1300. However, each point of this summary offers something unexpected. First of all, the rhyme structure developed by Dante creates a rhythm, both rigorous and infinite, that reproduces the tripartite division of the work at the level of each tercet. The privilege of visiting the afterlife while still possessing a body surpasses, as much as it recreates, that given to Aeneas, who travels to the underworld in the Aeneid, and to St. Paul, who describes having been raptured into paradise in the second letter to the Corinthians. Just as extraordinary is the fact that the protagonist is identified with not only the narrator, as in other medieval visions of the afterlife, but the historical individual known as Dante Alighieri. Dante once again dramatizes himself, but far more than in previous works. He asserts that he is himself this specific individual born under the sign of Gemini, a poet who has his own interests and memories. What about the date of the journey? Dante takes immediate and full advantage of the innovation begun by Pope Boniface VIII, his erstwhile rival, or rather, you can say antagonist, when he launched the first Christian year of Jubilee in 1300. But he does so by linking this period of universal salvation to his own life. The date corresponds to the year he turned 35, just before his mandate as prior at the summit of his political career, but also the midpoint of what the Middle Ages considered to be the average lifespan, that being 70. Finally, it is in the Commedia that the sum total of the philosophical, theological, historical, political, literary, mythological, scientific, cosmographic, astronomic, and existential knowledge gained by the incorrigibly curious author finds its place. Not only does the Commedia escape definition, it defies them. Through this work, Dante reshapes them, his radical form reinvention paralleled by the spiritual renewal that the poem proposes. It is therefore better to stick to the definitions that he himself gives. In the Inferno, he calls it a commedia, whereas Virgil's Aeneid is a tragedy. The term that would quickly become the title began as a way of means of highlighting the similarities between this poem, the sum of Christianity, and Virgil's epic, which was for Dante the sum of the ancient world, a prophecy of the empire, and one of his models. In the Paradiso, however, the Florentine underlines his divine inspiration that this is a consecrated poem, or even a sacred poem, to which both heaven and earth have set their hand. When the character narrator is entrusted with the mission of composing this poem by his ancestor, Caice Guido, his mission of his forefather speaks of a vision and a cry. The first term refers to the content of the poem, as well as to the technical definition of visio, text recounting mystical revelation, often on the subject of the afterlife. This meaning is then specified by the second term, a metaphor from prophetic rhetoric, corresponding to the same vox clamantatis that Dante takes from his letter to the Italian cardinals about the election of the successor of Clement V. Moreover, the attention given by Dante to the structure of his works is clear from the Vita Nuova onwards. The definition of an exceptional textual ensemble here raises the stakes even higher. The variation is not surprising. Dante tells us that the composition of the Commedia was ongoing for many years. Which years were these? If we compare the internal dating element, the references to history that are included in the poem, and the first mentions of it by its readers, we can calculate the delay between Dante putting the final touches to his cantiche at the moment at which they became accessible to the public, or cantice. Using this method, we can say that Dante was still working on the Inferno in 1310 and probably in 1312, and that this first part was circulating by the second half of 1314, when another banished Florentine, Francesco di Barberino, referred to it. The Purgatorio was still in progress by October of 1315, and the earliest evidence for its circulation comes from not long after. Some of Dante's lines inspired the tercets painted by Simone Martini under the Maester in the public palace of Siena in 1316, as well as the translation into the vernacular of the Aeneid by Lancia in 1316-17, and again by Ugo Ghieri at an unknown date. The most recent references to contemporary history in the Paradiso concern events that took place in 1316. The Commedia therefore occupied Dante for at least 10 years. And doubtless more, even if we cannot be certain. In reality, any hypothesis on the subject of genesis of the poem, its method of composition, or its entry into circulation, rests on a combination of textual analysis and external evidence, elements whose interpretation and dating are highly delicate. Three pieces of philological evidence must nonetheless be highlighted. First, the number of variants that can confidently be attributed to Dante, even in a poem of this size, is practically zero. Second, even if parts of the Commedia evidently circulated before Iaco compiled his manuscript in 1322, this does not necessarily mean that they were published as we might understand it today in 1322. Moreover, this early circulation has left only indirect traces in the sources. Finally, the comedy contain some internal inconsistencies. Taking these details together, it seems clear that Dante did not retouch his poem after it entered into circulation. Many scholars have connected this tripartite poem and its tercets to the Christian Trinity. This comparison also holds true on another level, the Commedia, and its lines are steeped in history, a history that goes ever forward and does not allow what has been said to be rewritten, only to be reinterpreted. The inverse is also true. The afterlife created by Dante in his poem has much solidity and such an appearance of eternity that has always been difficult to see it as a simple artifact. On the aspect of the Trinitarian conception and structure of the comedy into the Inferno, the Paradise, in the Purgatory and the Paradise, Something that calls to my mind is Joachim Fiore, who is one of the most essential sort of figures in historiography. And the reason he does so is because Joachim is able to conceive of the history as progressive and history as defined by epochs. And relating this back to Joachim, we're talking about all of Christian existence, Christian history being divided into three stages: the era of the Father, the era of the Son, and the era of the Holy Spirit. So, as this is as much you can say a theological history as any other sort of work in terms of trying to find a definition to it, which the New Lives doesn't attempt to, I think we can look back to this. Indeed, getting into the historiography of Joachim of Fiore is actually something I'm hoping for a future episode of this series in Truthable Chamber, but we'll see how far we get. This PowerPoint, this slide I have up at the moment, hopefully is going to be of some use when trying to ascertain exactly where we are in the grand scope of the Inferno. For this episode this evening, is going to be two parts, the Inferno. So I'll be referring to the aspects on the left, upper hell, at the limbo, and the vestibule. And I want to start off with the vestibule by reading a article by J.A. Berthold. And as with all of these segments, you can find the references for all the reading material in the description of this episode. It is well known that Dante's Inferno represents an ethical system worked out with a medieval zeal that at times borders on the pedantic. However, it must be said that this ethic is, for Dante, neither theoretical nor abstract, and that his own arrangement of sins into descending degrees of infamy is one which still strikes us in the 20th century as relevant and central. Of course, he's writing this in the 20th century, but updated for the 21st century, I believe it's just as relevant. His classification determines the geography of hell. Broadly speaking, the sins are divided into two groups: those inspired by perverted desire on the one hand, and those prompted by perverted will on the other. The latter, Dante considers more heinous for the reason that the whole man participates far more fully in their performance. We commit some sins because we are weak, others because we want to. In the first case, we have fought a battle which we have lost. In the second, we have not even lifted our arms from the wall. To the first group belong, in order of gravity, lasciviousness, gluttony, avarice, prodigality, the inversion of avarice, wrath, and violence. This order is determined by the increasingly antisocial direction of sin. The second group, situated in the lower hell, consists of the sins of fraud and deceit. These are further subdivided into two further categories: simple fraud, the thieves, the flatterers, the hypocrites, the diviners, and the like, and treachery. This last, to Dante, is the ultimate sin, for it implies the deliberate negation of trust and the power that binds man and man to man and man to God. The arch traitor in this scheme is Satan, who is fixed on the central axis of the globe, in the bottommost pit of the Inferno, as he masticates in his three jaws. Judas, betrayer of Christ and thus of the divine order, and Brutus and Cassius, betrayers of Caesar and thus of the secular order. This system, which derived as it is as much from the Aristotelian Thomistic ethic, i.e., St. Thomas of Aquinas, writing only a few decades earlier, may at times seem contrived and abstract, given the intense poetic life by the episode, by the episodes that fit into it. However, here we can penetrate into hell. We are not simply experiencing a physical descent, but a dizzying moral subsidence. And here he goes on to relate back to Canto 3, which I began this presentation on, by referring to the vestibule and what Dante would have been aware of Pope Celestine V's idea of the Great Refusal. And the Great Refusal, as we will find out, goes well beyond simple cowardice. I begin by drawing attention to an unusual and momentous episode that befalls Dante in the very first stage of his journey. Readers of the Inferno will remember that he is accompanied by his guide, teacher, and leader, the poet Virgil, one of whose many functions is to interpret and explain hell to him. No sooner has he crossed the infernal gate than he finds himself in a kind of antechamber or vestibule. He is not yet in hell proper, that is, he has not yet crossed the river Death, Acheron, nor yet met the savage bureaucrat Charon, who transports the souls to the Neverbank. As he looks about, therefore, he discovers a kind of no man's land, a place that admits neither life nor death. It is Dante's unique and original offering, for here he follows only minor precedents, like the one I mentioned with Celestine V, to those whose sole distinction is mediocrity, whose sole achievement, the fact that they have never done anything at all. Here reside in the phrase that T.S. Eliot used as a title to a poem that is a modern version of this Dante's Twilight world, the Hollow Men. And this is the scene taken, I'm using the Kirkpatrick translation, but here I'm reading from the Sinclair translation. There sighs, lamentations, and loud wailings resound through the stairless air, so that at first it made me weep, strange tongues, horrible language, words of pain, tones of anger, voice loud and hoarse, and with these the sound of hands made a tumult, which is whirling always through the air forever dark, as sand eddies in a whirlwind. And I, my head encircled with horror, said, Master, what is this I hear, and who are these people who seem to be mastered by their pain? And he said to me, This miserable state is borne by the wretched souls of those who lived without disgrace and without praise. They are mixed with the caitiff choir of the angels who are not rebels, nor faithful to God, but where for themselves the heavens drove them forth, not to be less fair, and the depth of hell does not receive them, lest the wicked have some glory over them. And I said, Master, what is it that is so grievous to them, making them lament so sorely? He replied, I will tell thee in a few words. They have no hope of death, and so abject is their blind life that they are envious of every other lot. Their world suffers no rapport of them to live. Pity and justice despise them. Let us not talk about them. Look through and pass. There are many striking features about this passage, but I think I may safely assert that it is not specially marked by Christian compassion. Indeed, the ferocity of Dante's tone is unusual. Consider Dante's reaction. As the whirling clamour breaks upon him, a band of horror encircles his head, and almost involuntarily he cries out, Who are these so vanquished by their pain? However, under his steadying effect of Virgil's calmly contemptuous explanation, his first rush of appalled sympathy begins to recede. Why do they lament so sorely? He asks again. And Virgil's reply is a model of insulting aloofness. Pity and justice despise them. Let us not talk of them, but look thou and pass. Dante looks, and the scene begins to assume something of the uncanny fascination of unique squalor. Those wretches who never were alive stream after a running banner, the emblem of their commitment, which shifts with every shift of fashion. Then, in the midst of rising abhorrence, Dante catches sight of him who made the great refusal, and with this glimpse, implacably, certainly replaces all of his remaining hesitation. He now realizes his mistake. Their pain, to which the uncomprehending mind responded with horror, is in fact trivial. The sole value of their grief lies in its being nourishment for bloated worms. There is nothing in literature, except perhaps Gulliver's Travels, to equal Dante's contempt for pettiness of personality. To him, neutrals are, in Sinclair's phrase, the waste and rubbish of the universe, vicarious beings whose fate is to envy, not the blessed, but the damned, and who, having evaded all reality in their lives, forbidden to experience the final reality of their death. This frightening violence of feeling is so unusual that it deserves, it seems, a primary place in an attempt to understand not the poet only, but the poem itself. Therefore, In the meantime, one may well observe that one has here the reaction of a man who believes that a life not greatly lived is not a life at all. It is Dante's considered view that it is better to sin greatly than to be indifferent to virtue, that it is better to feel the wrong passion than to be incapable of feeling. If the purpose of life is a moral one, then to assume a position of neutrality in front of life is to commit the unforgivable betrayal. Magnanimity of soul, energy of resolve, pride of ambition, these qualities in some measure at least are needed before one can speak of good and evil, of hell and paradise. It is scarcely necessary to add, in the light of the frightful epitaph which Dante has written for those who sacrifice virtue to caution and that possess the quality of magnanimo, greatness of soul, and what is more, knew that he did so. Indeed, the aspect of the Inferno in the broader comedy is substantive for us in terms of it being so autobiographical. There is a huge amount of self-awareness here. And as I alluded to in the last episode, if Dante is aware of anything, he is conscious of his own genius, yet again is not genius to the extent that he is a rebel against God or really his Catholic upbringing, or even you can say the influences and the things sort of percolating in his mind, his overall context and surroundings. Rather, Dante exemplifies a setting which I don't believe ever really represents a genuine attempt at rebellion, even though you can definitely interpret his political treatise, The Monarchia, in that way. So all of this is a call to action. But then again, it's not a call to excessive individuality. This isn't Nietzsche. This isn't will to power for the sake of will. This is will to power for the sake of human actualization, and not again for the self, but actualization so that one can be worthy of creation, not simply living vicariously. It is not enough to be created. One has to effectively become, as you can perhaps say Tolkien referred to, one has to become a sub-creator in their own right. And again, this is what differentiates someone like Dante being a Catholic from a non-Catholic, is that one is created and then one subcreates. One is doing it in accordance with the will of the original creator, which makes it again deeply Catholic and resonating. So I'm going to push back against this idea that Dante is necessarily indifferent to vice in a certain circumstance, because going further into the depths of the circles 10, second to five, these are sins of incontinence. These are sins essentially that have forced all of these denizens into a state of slavery. So what Dante is lamenting in the vestibule is a lack of will, but that is not to imply that the sinners of the upper hell have that much will either. So I think that has to be cautioned when looking at this and saying that Dante is a man of action, irrespective of what that action is, i.e. focusing on ambition as a virtue in and of itself. Ambition in this case would only be ambition to realize and essentially try and be an exemplar of that essentially which has been created. So now we're finally getting to the first circle, which is sometimes also referred to as the limbo, albeit I have a lot more to say when it comes to the more generalized aspects beyond the Inferno when it comes to Purgatorio. To hear on the first circle, some attained merit, but merit falls far short. None were baptized, none passed the gate in your belief to faith. They lived before the Christian age began. They paid no reverence, as was due to God. And in this number I myself am one, I referring to Virgil. For such deficiencies, no other crime, we are all are lost, yet only suffer harm, through living in desire, but hopelessly. At hearing this, great sorrows gripped my heart, for many persons of the greatest worth were held, I knew, suspended on the strip. Now, someone in the chat has already mentioned that Dante has been unfair in his conception of the pagans, but I don't really think that is the case. He tackles with this issue, I believe, very subtly, and in a way which I think actually has sort of profound implications. Notice how I'm focusing on the entry point before we even reach hell, because when we actually get into the upper hell, it actually becomes far more, you can say, obvious what Dante's conception intentions are, where it almost seems more interesting in the upper rung. So, for example, in the first circle, Dante encounters Homer, Horace, Ovid, and Lucan. And of course, with Virgil, Dante, of course, being effectively self-admitted to be a genius, considers himself to be the sixth of the great sort of poetic sextet. So Dante, as you can say, almost remorseful, as was made clear in that extract, remorseful of the fact that the pagans do not essentially share in his baptism. Just a note on Ovid, though, interestingly enough, is that Kirkpatrick, in his introduction to the his translation of Dante, considers perhaps that Ovid is the greater influence on the Inferno than the ever-present Virgil, in virtually all senses of that word, because Ovid and his metamorphosis, and we have the drama, his exquisite descriptions, the changing nature of the world, and the idea of bestial transformation and various allegorical allusions, and Kirkpatrick considers these all to be somewhat anti-Virgilian in comparison to the Aeneid. Indeed, the Aeneid can perhaps form a template, but this also indicates that, as with all things to refer to Dante, Dante is not derivative in one sense, as easy as it would say, for example, to just say, oh, Dante is here only playing homage to the Aeneid. No, it's got so much more depth than that. So that's one consideration. Dante considers himself part of a literary poetic canon among the greats of antiquity, of which he has one foot in antiquity, one foot in the medieval era. Then, of course, we get to the figures associated with his infatuation with Aeneas. So the figures of the Trojan Wars, Aeneas himself, Hector, and Julius Caesar, of course. We have other more interesting figures, you can say, because I think this again impacts on what I brought up at the beginning, which is the utility in seeing the Inferno as a window into the medieval historical mindset, because Dante has included Saladin in the first rung among the honorable pagans. And this explicitly is due to the fact that he considers Saladin, who would have only died about 100 years before, as a virtuous, again, it wouldn't be pagan, but from the Christian point of view, infidel or heathen leader of the Crusades, due to his merciful conduct when it came to the siege of Jerusalem. So it's interesting that that isn't some, you know, some sort of modern sort of philo-Islamic sympathy. That is very much something that medievals were cognizant of when they viewed the other side. So those are the second great company, because, of course, Dante being part of the sextet, of course, the poets have the most exalted place within the first circle. But when we get to the third, we have a group again, which I think is rather controversial, placing them here, which are the philosophers. So we're talking Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, Diogenes. Of course, it should be noted that not all the philosophers are included in this, all the Greek philosophers, all the big names. There are certain gradations, but then, of course, in addition to the Greek philosophers, we have Cicero, and of course we have Seneca. And all this does, I think, is to establish an essential understanding for how we can talk about the idea of salvation, of baptism, and consider this idea of Christian universalism. Perhaps you can say this is even more, you know, needed in terms of assessment in the context of the controversy of Vatican II's Dignitatis Humanae. But it's not just universalism in terms of geography, i.e. the confines of the geographic sort of limitations of Christendom, but this is Christian universalism within all times. You know, the harrowing of hell is very useful, I think, in terms of Christians' understanding that Christ, again, was the prophesied one. He is the Messiah. He has come to judge the living and the dead, and his reign will have no end. The whole basis of that, again, is that God being eternal, the Trinity being God, and God being eternal, means that, again, judgment, it seems, the temporal existence, where you exist in time, seems almost irrelevant. So Dante's consideration here, you can almost say, is that in the first circle, perhaps it is that all of these virtuous pagans may have now become aware, self-aware, that they are within the first circle. But part of the reason they have remained there is, you can say, an aspect of, I don't know, you can say pagan sort of being fast paganism, not wanting essentially to open oneself up beyond the exemplar that was Romano-Greek philosophy, to accept essentially the truth within Christianity. It's interesting here, and this again bears more consideration to the role of scripture and the Bible in informing Dante. Indeed, just bring up again, this is a Dante. The images that I'm using here are Dore's famous engravings. You may have noticed with the first slide, that was Hieronymus Bosch. The cover for this stream is Eugene Delacroix. And Dore here is going to be used quite extensively in this series because, again, he's intended as a companion to Dante. And as we have on the first on the left, we have essentially the cowards. Here on the right, we have the virtuous pagans. But I'm going to be reading from the Cambridge Companion, a chapter called Dante and the Bible, and this is by Peter S. Hawkins. Underwriting the entire world in which Dante lived is a single book, the Bible. Believed to be authored by a god who chose human scribes to speak his word, it has an authority quite beyond any human text. For this reason, it was the most studied book in the medieval era. Both the primer on which the young clerk learned his alphabet and the sacred page that dominated every branch of higher learning. Not that the power of scripture was limited to school or the literate. As the holy book of the church, it informed not only liturgy and preaching, art and architecture, but also constituted a vast and complex symbolic network that was intelligible on whatever level to all classes of society. Far more than Latin, the Bible itself was the universal language of Christian culture. And again, that really shouldn't come as a surprise. It is not surprising, then, that when Dante's writings are considered as a whole, the Christian scriptures should be the source more referenced than and alluded to than any other work. By one count, there are 575 citations to the Bible in Dante, compared to around 400 in Aristotle and 200 in Virgil. Calculations of this sort, however, do not suggest the degree to which Dante absorbed the word of the Bible. This is most notably true in the Comedy, where the Old and New Testaments, both in Latin and in the vernacular translation, so permeate his language, almost to become one with it. Sometimes the poet will quote the Bible, or will openly draw attention to its relevance. Far more often, however, he will allow its presence to go unannounced, relying on the reader to catch the biblical resonance and make something of it. A case in point is the first, very first line of the Comedy, coming immediately before Dante tells the reader of his terrifying experience in the dark wood and of his resolve to recall it, because of the good that I found there, without apparent resort to any other text or authority. Indeed, in a line that comes to personalize him as readily as his own name, he begins, Nel mezzo di calma di nostra vita. Here the poem opens his work by telling time he is in the middle of the journey of our life. And again, the middle of the journey of our life, it's a reference to many sort of comparisons you can find to classical literature. One, of course, is the Iliad. And another one, which I was actually rereading quite recently, is the Ethiopica. When this line comes later to be annotated, commentators will remind the reader that the journey through the afterlife is set during the Holy Week of 1300, that the poet was born in 1265, and therefore that he is 35 years old. But none of this additional information is necessary for one who remembers that the span of our life is already a known quantity, as stated in Psalm 89, the days of our years are 70 years. And again, I hate to sort of lower the tone, but to anyone who still thinks that people in the medieval era all died at the age of 35 are simply basing this off aggregates formulated around infant mortality rates, when it was essentially accepted for thousands of years before medicine increased the life expectancy, that one had essentially reached the end of his years when he was 70. Not is this verse from the Psalms the only biblical text at play here. From Dante's recollection, and again, what they reference here again is to the 70 years, is that there are multiple meanings to being, again, finding oneself in the middle. One is in the middle of life, essentially, leading into the situation. There is a reference again to Greek literature and ancient Greek mythology, but also to the Psalms. For in Dante's recollection of the events that took place him, in the middle of the journey of our life, he also echoes King Hezekiah in Isaiah, whose song of thanksgiving is written down in the prophet's book to commemorate, to rescue from mortal illness. I said, in the middle of my days, I shall go to the gates of hell. In this biblical passage, we find a great deal more than a commonplace allusion to life's 70. Instead, we have a scriptural subtext for Dante's larger effort in the comedy. Opening his own story of salvation from the powers of death, he appropriates the parallel experience of Hezekiah. A man saved by God's intervention from the pit of destruction, who afterwards looks back and writes about his deliverance. In his influential commentary on this passage, St. Jerome noted that while a good man dies at the end of his days, the sinner comes to the gates of hell in the midst of his life. Dante's losing his way, therefore, is a confession of his spiritual lostness, a tacit admission from the very outset that he was, to quote Jerome's gloss in Isaiah, in the shadow of errors that lead to hell. Again, if we consider the lives of Dante, perhaps, again, I'm reading too much into this, especially as the Inferno was the first work to be completed, but if it wasn't circulated until 1314 and then wasn't adapted after that, maybe the impending or the fact of Dante's exile may have weighed here in terms of his conception or retroactive understanding by placing this in the year 1300. The opening line of the comedy reveals in miniature the biblical matrix of Dante's imagination. He assumes the psalm's estimation of our lifespan, draws not only upon a single sentence, but upon a narrative moment in the book of Isaiah, and then adapts for his own purposes an ancient exegetical tradition on what it means to face hell in the middle of one's days. Does it follow, then, that he was consciously deploying all the texts, patristic as well as biblical, when he sat down to begin the poem? Probably not. More likely, he was writing out a fund of scriptural metaphor and narrative so deeply assimilated as to be second nature, more of a mother tongue than a foreign language deliberately acquired. And this, again, I can reference sort of my understanding of Tolkien studies and refer to the cauldron of story or the leaf mould of the mind. Again, this is all going back to intellectual context and why it's so important to situate all sort of significant works of literature and philosophy, I believe, within a certain historical context. I mean, at least from my understanding, much later in life, reading works again and again and again, I always find, especially rereading Hobbes recently, situating that within the politics of the middle of the 17th century has helped immensely. But of course, for Dante, this should be obvious. In this regard, he was no doubt like most of his contemporaries, whose experience of scripture came primarily from the whole sensorium of medieval culture, and not from study, who heard and saw the Bible rather than read it. If simple enumeration of biblical references is not in itself definitive, it is nonetheless instructive to note patterns within the three canticles. Given Dante's overt dependence on classical sources in the Inferno, as well as the rejection of God exemplified in those who have lost the good of intellect, it comes as no surprise that hell should include the fewest direct citations of scripture. Nor is it difficult to see why in the paradise, However, the comedy is a narrative before it is a theology, or more precisely, the theology evolves with the narrative, sometimes more, sometimes less explicitly, and it seems more faithful to that theology to discuss in rough narrative order theological dimensions of a few of the major actors and events in the journey. Familiarity with Dante's text and lack of familiarity with the theology of Dante's age often combine to blunt the edges of many of the comedy's surprises. So it is, I suspect, with the appearance of Virgil as the first dramatic person of the poem, apart from Dante himself. Yet surprised it ought to be, for Dante's guide through most of the journey in the realms beyond death is a pagan. It will transpire there are many features of those realms with which Virgil is unfamiliar, yet one senses unmistakably throughout the Inferno and the Purgatorio until the earthly paradise is reached that Virgil is fundamentally at home. He can guide Dante because basically he knows whereof he speaks. It soon becomes apparent in the action of the comedy, furthermore, that Virgil is not a lone case in this human grandeur and pathos. In the first circle of hell, Inferno 4, entirely different in its melancholy, courtesy, and gentle light from the violent darkness of the lower circles, is the eternal dwelling of many pagan spirits, notably those distinguished in a wide variety of walks of life. What is Dante signalling through the choice of this pagan as his principal guide, referring back to the whole context of the first circle here? He is indicating two things at least, although each will become fully apparent only as the Inferno evolves. What the appearance of Virgil immediately suggests, through his being appointed, more precisely requested, by Beatrice, who again, the embodiment of love, but also beatitude, heavenly salvation, the beatific vision, as I brought up earlier on, to guide Dante through the realms of sin, is that Virgil is aware of what constitutes those sins, and is not blinded to their nature by having been tainted by them. This in turn suggests that he essentially is a preliminary to the contact with God towards which Dante aspires, is moral purity, or put more sharply, that ethics is in a sense the foundation of life with God. The unfolding of the narrative amply confirms this initiative sense of the significance of Virgil. Speaking of the pagans, eternally imprisoned in the first circle, of whom he is one, Virgil states briefly, "They did not sin." This impression that Virgil, like the other pagans in the circle, is without moral fault, is reinforced by this conduct in hell. But it is not, in fact, until the beginning of the Purgatorio that the impression is explicitly confirmed. They're referring to the moral virtues. Virgil declares of these pagans, "Without fault they knew the moral virtues and carried them out in their entirety." Virgil, then the epitome, or epitome, of the virtuous pagan, suggests by his person and his words that God will be revealed only when the human being lives a moral life. Indeed, the very structure of the Inferno and the Purgatorio conveys the point. With the partial exception of the sin of heresy, condemned in the Circle 6, none of the sins published in hell, punished in hell, and purged in purgatory are specifically Christian. All lie within the moral ambit of human capability. The choice of Virgil as guide signifies, then, that what God requires first for happiness on earth and happiness in eternity is the living out of moral virtues, and that with or without the aid of grace, moral perfection lies within human reach. This point would strike home all the more forcefully to Dante's contemporaries, since according to the common theological tradition of the time, no figure as Dante's Virgil could exist. For theologians of that period, no pagan untouched by the grace of God could live a morally perfect life. The bias of original sin inherited from Adam would lead him inevitably to sin personally. Viewed against this background of such a tradition, Dante's Virgil stands as a quite unexpected testimony to the primary importance of moral virtue. However, if Virgil's first witness to what he has, the moral virtues, he no less importantly points to what he has not, eternal happiness. The starkest fact about Virgil is that his eternal dwelling is hell, not heaven. If we glide over or obscure that fact, we miss not just a crucial part of Dante's theology, but Dante the man. It would be trite to reduce the varieties of pain and evil in hell to mere variations on a theme, but all the inhabitants of hell do share the common characteristic, like the virtuous pagans. They have failed to attain the good which would satisfy their highest power, reason. They have eternally lost God. The horrendous physical pains of hell are in addition to the single negative pain, whose bare essence is endured by the virtuous pagan who, as Virgil puts it, without hope, live in desire. This is undoubtedly an aspect of the comedy which most modern readers find difficult to seriously consider, far less feel sympathy towards. It is, however, we would enter into the mind of the man who wrote the comedy, into what impelled him to write the poem. Then we must ponder the basic fact that in his eyes, Virgil is eternally unfulfilled, and the sinners are forever in torment. For Virgil and the virtuous pagans, this is tragedy in the strictest sense, for the eternal denouement of the moral life has come about inevitably despite their best endeavours. For the sinners, proper their fate is the result not of tragedy but of folly. It is because of their worst endeavours that their eternal fate quite unnecessarily comes about. So moving on from, again, less you can say the judgment, but more, as has been pointed out, the tragedy that represents the first circle, and what we really have to consider when it comes to concepts such as original sin and the idea of baptism and the unity of the church and no salvation outside the church, and how these things again exist historically before time as they do geographically. That again is going to come up when I discuss purgatory, but finally moving in to upper hell and beginning with the second circle, we have Minos, who essentially is the confessor of sin in order to enter the hell proper. And of course, Minos is based on Minos of Crete, whom here Dante has essentially cast in the role of the judge Rhadamanthus, who also happened to be another king of Crete. In order to get in, Virgil has to rebuke Minos before essentially witnessing the denizens of the circle of lust. And again, this is important. This is a journey. Dante doesn't have to essentially be admitted into the ranks of hell in terms of being able to descend. But one of the novelties of having Minos again, Minos of the Labyrinth, hence the Minotaur, who it again makes an appearance later down as the depths of hell, Minos, in the guise again of a serpent, essentially declares the rung upon which the person entering into hell will descend, based on essentially the level of which his tail has been coiled. So very sort of fascinating imagery in terms of, again, the something he's going to bring up time and time again in terms of the association of transformation and metamorphosis with certain creatures having originally been human beings, now have come to assume these eternal roles, whether it be Minos, whether it be Cerberus, whether it be Geryon. But as we're sort of entering here, we have now finally entered into hell, and Dante is seeing the circle of lust. Here he sees Queen Dido, Dido, who is the jilted lover of Aeneas, and then orders sort of historic revenge to be cast down a curse upon the house of Aeneas. And of course, this is the Virgilian way of orchestrating the historical epic between the Rome and Carthage and the Punic Wars. Added again to Aeneas, we have the forerunner, Helen of Troy. Helen of Troy, who spurned Sparta to go off with Paris, thereby causing that war, and by proxy also causing the foundation of Rome through Aeneas. And then, of course, we have other figures such as Tristan, of Tristan and Isolde and their forbidden love, which again, Wagner would turn into an incredible opera. But in terms of being able to understand this predicament beyond these figures essentially of myth and antiquity, he is told the predicament of the denizens of the Circle of Lust through one Francesca Rimini, who in his time was an infamous adulterer. You should also note that I'm using two images. One on the right is Dore and his engraving, but an image on the left, which I think is, you know, perhaps far more evocative, perhaps solely due to the basis of colour, is William Blake's iteration of exactly what I'm going to read out in Canto 5. The swirling wind of hell will never rest. It drags these spirits onwards in its force. It chafes them, rolling, clashing grievously. Then once they reach the point from which they fell, screams, keening cries, and the agony of all, and all blaspheming at the holy power. Caught in this torment, as I understood, were those who, here condemned for carnal sin, made reason bow to their instinctual bent, as starlings on the wind and winter chills are borne along in the wide and teeming flocks, so on those breathing gusts of evil souls. This way and that and up and down they are borne. Here is no hope of any comfort ever, neither of respite nor of lesser pain. Love, who so fast brings flame to generous hearts, seized him with feeling for that lovely form. Again, the testimony of Francesca. Now torn from me, the harm of how still rankles, love who no loved one's pardon loves requite, sees me, for him no strong, so strongly in delight, that as you see, he does not leave me yet. Love drew me us onwards to consuming death. Cain's ice awaits the one who quenched our lives. These words born unto us from them were theirs. And when I heard these spirits in distress, I bowed my eyes and held them low, until at length the poet said, "What thoughts are these?" I, answering in the end, began, "Alas, how many yearning thoughts, what great desire, have led them through such horror to their fate?" And turning to them now, I came to say, "Francesca, how your suffering saddens me. Sheer pity brings me to the point of tears. But tell me this, the how of it, and why, that love and sweetness of such sighing hours permitted you to know these doubtful pangs." To me, she said, "There is no sorrow greater than, in times of misery, to hold at heart the memory of happiness." I think this is, again, you can say, a very revealing passage into Dante's own life, not just in terms of his infatuation with Beatrice, not just infatuation, you can deification of Beatrice, not deification in a literal sense, of course, which Dante would consider blasphemy, but making her the beatific vision in and of itself, being the means with which he can communicate with the heavenly paradise. We see this with Vita Nuova, and she reaches her apex in a literal as well as metaphorical sense when it comes to the comedy. But in terms of no greater happiness than happiness lost, again, if we're looking at this and using Francesco Rimini as some sort of autobiographical intercession, then we can see this as the loss of Beatrice in her physical form, the real Beatrice, who died long before this point of him supposedly beginning this in the middle of his life at 35 and 300. So it is not, but also there's something more revealing in this. It's not just the deification of again love. It is not just a love lost. It is, again, lust is not simply love in terms of it's not an elevated thought. It is love for love's sake, i.e. sex. It is passion. And much of what has essentially been associated here, as with Dido, who was corrupted by an infatuation with Aeneas, Helen of Troy, who by proxy is essentially responsible for a 10-year war by her infatuation with Paris, and Tristan's infatuation with Isolde, which will lead to both their deaths. It is love at the cost of everything. It is adultery. It is, again, a love essentially which brooks no opposition. And this isn't also the only place where Dante confines love. Love is projected outwards into the Purgatorio and in a form into the paradise in different forms. But this, you can say, is the most tragic aspect of hell. It's the most sophisticated aspect of it. But nevertheless, it is the most degraded form of affection here. There is also a reference to, in terms of all the sort of going back to Tolkien, the cauldron of story and all of these various inferences, we come to figures such as Lancelot and Guinevere. Guinevere's adultery, and we go to the old French Grail cycle, and this idea of him being impressed, Dante being impressed from the courtly romantic literature of the preceding few centuries. Indeed, not only in terms of the style of old French literature also, but going back to what I said actually in episode one, which is these various influences, poetic influences on Dante, and them coming to an understanding and appreciation of the uses of the vernacular, not just, you can say, in the more trite sense of using the vernacular, the local tongue, as a means of wooing girls and seducing them through poetry, but in a sense of essentially allowing for Tuscan and later what we see Tuscan as being the vehicle for the modern Italian language, essentially, as essentially being, not, you can say, beyond his ability to communicate to commoners and people beyond, you can say, the limitations placed around Latin to an intelligentsia. But Dante's way of using the Tuscan dialect has again immortalized him within the whole scheme of Italian sort of historical mythology. So now we come to the third circle, and I'm reading from Canto 6. I am in circle 3, and rain falls there, endlessly chill, accursed and heavy, in rate and composition never new. Snow, massive hailstones, black tainted water, pour down in sheets through tenebrae of air. The earth absorbs it in all and stinks revoltingly. Cerberus, weird and monstrously cruel, barks from his triple throat and cur like yowls over the heads of those who lie there drowned. Another painting by William Blake. His eyes vermilion, beard a greasy black, his belly broad, his fingers all sharp nailed, he mauls and skins, then hacks and fore these souls. From all of them, rain writing a wet dog howl, they squirm as flank screens flank, they twist, they turn, and then these vile profanities, they turn again. The reptile Cerberus now glimpsed us there. He stretched his jaws, he showed us in all his fangs, and me, no member in my frame stayed still. My leader, referring to Virgil, bending with his palms wide span, scooped dirt in each hand, and then his fists both full, hurled these at sops down all three of the ravenous throats. A hungry mongrel, yapping, thrusting out, intent on nothing but the meal to come, is silent only when its teeth sink in. In each instance, Virgil, as with his contemptuous sating of Cerberus as the il gran vermo, the great worm with a mouthful of mud, is acting both as a guide and protector in sating the manifestations that befall them through the inferno. In this third cycle, sensuality has degraded into something which is purely addictive self-indulgence, hence how we can refer to these as the sins of incontinence. It is a form of slavery, both in life and in the fixed position. The gluttons and their ilk in the upper hell are condemned to this form of death. And you can say again, compared to, you can say, the more active deceit of the lower hell, again, this whole sort of atmosphere again is so pitiable, because as we're going to see from Virgil time and time again, Virgil warns off Dante from even looking at these creatures, from even trying to interact with them, because they have essentially become the embodiment of sin. So we're not just talking about metamorphosis in the sense of these, you know, of creatures like Cerberus being some sort of allegory again for gluttony, or various allegories of human beings being transformed into this and that, but we're talking about human beings themselves, those representing some sort of sin, becoming a animalistic iteration of those sins. And that is a constant theme, which it doesn't reach its height here, but the depravity of those instances only becomes worse and worse and worse as the sin becomes the man. In the fourth circle, we are introduced to Plutus. And Plutus is the Roman god of wealth, and he greets the pair with the ever elusive phrase Papa Satan. And this is a theory rabbit hole. If you want to go into that, you can look it up, but there has never been a sort of definitive theory as to essentially what is meant in the sort of first articles of Canto 7 when Pluto greets the two by saying that, and essentially what the implication is, not just Papa Satan, sometimes rendered as Popeye Satan or Eleazarol. But it's important to note again for people who aren't so well versed in Greek mythology that Plutus is a distinctive entity from Pluto. Pluto, who is essentially the Latin counterpart of Hades himself. So it'll be rather awkward meeting the god Hades in this rather insignificant corner of the upper hell. This aspect, this circle, exists for the avaricious. for the avariciousness of, again, of avarice, essentially. And Dante is not prepared to mince words when vaguely condemning various popes and cardinals to this hell. And I think this is, again, even though it's not explicit, it may be an indication of, to Dante, the thin line between the opulence and the grand aesthetic of the Catholic Church, which is there meant to glorify God, and those things as being means to glorify and indulge the self, in which case they essentially become a form of avariciousness. Again, I don't need to hark on that even, you know, after Dante, horde of Renaissance popes that would necessarily fit this picture. But in case of what the implications are of avarice, with avarice, the sinners are literally bound to this plane. They are bound by the physical weight of their hordes. And in terms of just finding a more modern comparison to this, you know, I instantly think of Charles Dickens and the chains of the greed of the Marleys, who were dead to be of Marley, who was dead to begin with, essentially, the physical weight of one's hoard, the chains that one wears after death. Beyond this overt allegory of wealth as representing an end in and of itself as a form of self-consumption with Plutus, Virgil here is also alluding to the fickle nature of fortune that raises on high only to plunge one into the pits of poverty. The chains of the damned to fickle fortune have deprived them essentially of their individuality, which is a consistent theme I've been mentioning through here. The moral condemnation evokes the nature of Plutus himself. In Greek mythology, for Plutus is not only the personification of wealth, but from whose name we derive the etymologies of plutocrat, essentially a ruler deriving his wealth, his right to rule essentially from wealth, hence plutocracy, and plutomania, the obsession or the love of wealth. For circle five, in addition to Doré, I have this very evocative and colourful image on the left by Stradanus, who was making these mock-ups of the Inferno about 200 years after Dante's death. And here I'm reading from Canto 7, referring to the fifth circle, the rough, the crossing of the river, and you can say the ooze, which I'm going to simply refer to it, but you'll see what I mean in terms of the supreme example of bondage to sin. We approached the margins of a spring, which seething spilled and ran from there along an outer sluice. The waters here were darker, far than Perse. So unaccompanied by murky waves, downwards we travelled by a weirder route into a swamp, by name the Loathsome Styx. This melancholy brook makes way and finds the foot of those malignant grey-black slopes. As where I stood, intent and wondering, I saw there plunge within the stagnant fen a peevish people, naked, caked with mud, each battered, each, and not with fists alone, also with headbutts, kicks, and charging chests, their teeth too, tore them bit by bit to shreds. You witness now, my gentle teacher said, the souls of those whom anger overthrew. And this I'd also have you know, be sure, beneath the surface of this slick, are some of whose sighs, as you can see at every turn, now aerate the palating film. So struck there fast, in slime they hum, mournful we were. Sunlight rejoices the balmy air. We, though within ourselves, nurse sullen fumes, and come to misery in this black ooze. That is the hymn each gurgles in his gorge, unable to articulate a single phrase. I think perhaps there is also a more sort of descriptive reference to this, not just in hell, but also in terms of being able to actually quantify wrath. You know, I can speak from personal experience in terms of when one is so overwrought by rage and to the point it essentially consumes you, that you almost find it difficult to speak. But imagine it effectively stuck. You're stuck in this state for all of eternity, that feverish pitch of rage to the point that it consumes your very soul. And of course, in such a state, you have very limited capacity for reason. And of course, you really care for nothing else apart from basically to sate that rage by whatever means necessary. And thereby, as we see with gluttony, and as we see with avarice, and to a much lesser extent, lust, it is the sort of sin which transforms, metamorphoses, and destroys. And am getting mad to the point of raging. Yes, funny enough, I do have a wide range of emotions, believe it or not. Here we reached, in fine, the bottom of a tower. And so I say, continuing, that long before we reached the bottom of that lofty tower, our eyes had travelled upwards to the summit, drawn by a pair of tiny flames set there, as now we saw, to signal to a third, so far away the eye could hardly grasp it. I turned towards the ocean of all wisdom. What do they mean? I said to him. What answer does the Father Fire now give? Who makes these signs? And he, across those waves of foaming mire, you may already glimpse what they have been waiting for. You may already glimpse, unless it still goes hidden by these marshy fumes. No bowstring ever shot through air an arrow rapider than now. At speed I saw come on towards us there a mean little vessel, within it, as pilot plying these waters, a single galleyman who strained the oar, squealing, "You fiend! You've got it coming now!" "Phelagias! Phelagias!" my master said. "Your screams and shouts have this time little point. We're yours, but only while we come this marsh, like someone hearing that a massive hoax has just, to his disgruntlement, been pulled on him." So Phelagias now stood in pent-up rage. My lord stepped down, and entering the boat, he made me, in my turn, embark behind. The hull seemed laden, only when I did. At once my leader boarded, me as well, the ancient prow put out. It soared the waves more deeply than it would with other crews. So rushing forwards on the lifeless slick, there jerked up fronting me one brimming slime who spoke, "So, who you come too soon are you?" And my riposte, "I come perhaps, I'll not remain. But who might you be?" brutishly befouled. His answer was just, "Look at me. I am one who weeps." And I to him, "Weep on in grief. May you remain, you spirit of damnation. I know who you are, filth as you may be." And then he stretched both hands towards our gunwales. My teacher, though alert, soon drove him back, saying, "Get down, be off with all that dog pack." And then he wringed both arms around my neck. He kissed my face, then said, "You wrathful soul, blessed the one that held you in her womb." That man alive flaunted his arrogance, and nothing good adorns his memory. So here his shadow is possessed with rage. How many in the world above pose there as kings, but here will lie like pigs in muck, leaving behind them horrible displays. "Sir," I replied, "this I should really like before we make our way beyond this lake, to see him dabbled in the minestrone." He gave me an answer. "Before that shore has come to view, you'll surely have your fill, and rightly you'll rejoice in this desire." Then moments on, I saw the sinner ripped to vicious tatters by the mud-caked lot. I praise God still, and still give thanks for that. "Get him," they howled. "Let's get him, that crazy Florentine." He bucked, he balked, turning the gelf turned teeth upon himself. We left him there. Of him my story tells no more. And yet my ears were pierced with cries of pain, at which I barred my eyes intently forward. On the precipice of the city of Dis, which is essentially the host for the lower circle, Dante is accosted by Argenti, the Guelph. The insinuation is that the Argenti family had played a part in the seizure of Dante's property in Florence when he was forced into exile. Indeed, this is an unremarkable reminder of Dante's exile and a realization of Dante's own sense of injustice done unto him. Yet, this is also compelled with an awareness of his own sin. Though Argenti is already condemned to the muck and torn apart by the other sinners, Dante still has hopes of redemption. And I want to reread that short segment, which is, "And my riposte, I come perhaps, I'll not remain, but who might you brutishly befouled? His answer was just, look at me, I am one who weeps, and I to him, in grief, may you remain, you spirit of damnation. I know who you are, filth as you may be." And then in response to this, Virgil replies, "You wrathful soul, having kissed him, blessed the one that held you in her room, in her womb." Here, it has been referenced earlier that there are many hints of scripture seeded throughout the Inferno and the entire comedy, and that to essentially have a blinkered understanding which isn't informed by this, or a non-Christian understanding, has, quote, essentially blunted the edges of the incisiveness, essentially, of this. And this is because Virgil is echoing a response within the Gospel of Luke, and to this, Christ responds in Luke, "Blessed rather are those who hear the word of God and obey it." It is possible that those actually reading may have understood this and understand that there is a brief temptation here, that within the whole scheme of the loss of his citizenship over Florence and his own intent essentially to treat the wrathful as they are intent to treat him, that Dante is going over to sin. But in the end, he must hear the word of God and obey it.